This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Nathan Wolf, the Laurie I. Loki Visiting Professor in Human Biology at Stanford University and the founder and CEO of Global Viral Forecasting, an independent research institute devoted to early detection and control of epidemics. Nathan Wolf received his undergraduate degree at Stanford and his doctorate in immunology and infectious diseases from Harvard. He has been published in or profiled by a variety of publications, including Nature, Science, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Economist. In 2011, he was named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Nathan Wolf is here today to tell us about his book, The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age, published in October 2011. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
What led you to write your book, The Viral Storm? What is your goal?
Well, this is work that I've been doing over the last 15 years or so of my life. And to a certain extent, from a personal perspective, it was about creating a little bit of a bookend. I've spent a lot of time publishing for the academic press, and I wanted to be able to communicate the ideas and the concepts that we had developed to a general audience. And I think the concepts are something that it's important for people to understand.
What is your definition of pandemic?
Well, look, at the end of the day, we can come up with a dozen different definitions of pandemics, and people will debate them. If there is a virus, a new virus or a microorganism that enters into humans and basically gets to every continent on the planet, from my perspective, that's good enough for us to consider it to be a pandemic. It's one of these situations where we're so ridiculously interconnected as a planet now, that if something has reached every corner of the world, every continent, even if it's just a few individuals who are infected, what that means is that individuals on each of those continents are going to have the potential to infect many other individuals. So, you know, from my perspective, if it hits everywhere, we can call it a pandemic.
How important is the deadliness of a microbe and its ability to become a pandemic agent?
Well, that's, again, a really interesting question. For me, when I think about these things, I sort of imagine in my mind two dials. And the reason why they're dials is because they can change over time. A lot of these viruses mutate and recombine with each other to make completely new forms. So we don't have static viral epidemics or pandemics. But the key variables really are how deadly is it and how much does it have the capacity to spread. People tend to focus a lot in the general public on how deadly it is, and certainly viruses like Ebola bring to mind a lot of fear and attention. But to a certain extent, for those of us who study them, transmissibility is equally important, if not in some ways more important. You can imagine a virus that was not particularly deadly but was very, very transmissible, and it could do a tremendous amount of damage. And there's viruses like that that occur even now. You can think of something like human papillomavirus, which is obviously a virus that humans have had for a long period of time, not one of these new epidemics. But even though it kills a small percentage of individuals that it infects, the fact that it's so transmissible and that, you know, one out of every three or four sexually active adults has this virus means that the damage it can do is really mind-boggling.
Of the microbes that cause disease in humans, why have you chosen to emphasize viruses?
Well, we actually do quite a bit of work on other sets of microorganisms. We spend a lot of time looking at sort of new varieties of malaria and trying to understand the origins of malaria, which that, of course, is a parasite. And we're not only focused on viruses, but if you look at the major pandemics that have swept into human populations and had a major impact over the last 100 or 200 years, those have been dominated by viruses. And so those tend to be the ones that we're really spending our time thinking about.
How do the number of pandemics we encounter now compare to the number of pandemics in the past?
Well, the world is really a fundamentally different place than it was even 30 or 40 years ago, and certainly it's a dramatically different place than it was 100 years ago. There's virtually nowhere in the world now that's not connected in one way or another to the global grid. I have a great figure that I'll often show of this number of flights connecting different locations during, say, the 30s or 40s, and the number of flights, say, 5 or 10 years ago. And one looks like a few strings on a map that you've connected with different tacks on your map, and the more current one looks like a plate of spaghetti. There's really almost no place on the planet, including some of the very, very rural locations, sort of end-of-the-road, deep forest locations that we work in, that viruses from those places can't get everywhere within the course of a few days. So we really do live in a dramatically different world.
Could you just very briefly touch on some of the key pandemics over time that have been significant for our human population?
I mean, certainly you go back to smallpox is a very dramatic one, but I think the one that perhaps warrants the most thought from our perspective would be HIV, which we now don't think of it as a pandemic. We think of it as almost sort of a chronic disease that affects us. But the reality is this is a virus that, you know, 100 years ago infected almost nobody, a handful of individuals. It's something that has spread around the world globally, infecting tens of millions of individuals, and I think we must consider it to be one of the most important biological events of the 20th century. But certainly all the influenza outbreaks and pandemics tend to be very, very important and I think are worth thinking about. And then from time to time, we also have these very interesting ones like SARS, which is this global pandemic that sort of occurred out of the blue, if you will. I mean, all of us now know that this is the kind of mechanism that leads to these pandemics, the contact of humans and animals. But this is a virus in a class of viruses, the coronaviruses, that we had been familiar with, but it never really led to a pandemic of the sort that it did.
What do we know about how pandemics start?
Well, we actually know quite a bit about that, and this is part of the work that I describe in the book and that my organization, Global Viral Forecasting, does around the world with our partners. These new viruses and other microorganisms have to come from somewhere. And so the reality is when we think about any microorganism that's spreading in humans, we have to ask ourselves, well, is this something that's been in our ancestors for a long time, or did this enter into us from another species? And by and large, those are wild animal species. Not to say that domestic animals can't play an important role, and we see this in a lot of these influenza viruses, but at the end of the day, we've been interacting with domestic animals for many thousands and in some cases tens of thousands of years. So most of the microbes that are indigenous to these domestic animals will already have entered into humans if they had the potential to do so. And by far the greatest diversity of novel microorganisms is out there in wild animals. And so really in some ways it's either direct contact with wild animals or indirect contact with wild animals through domestic animals that may be a bridge or a mosquito or another sort of vector insect. But to make a long story short, these things come from wild animals.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nathan Wolf, author of the book The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You've alluded to this earlier, but would you say more about the features of modern society that make us particularly vulnerable to pandemics?
Well, again, it's sort of easy to forget now, but if we go back, you know, even 50 or 100 years, most people in the world were living simply off of local animals that they would either be farming or hunting in regions near their home. And those village settings would be in some ways independent from each other, although somewhat connected. They wouldn't be connected like they are now. We now live in this world where animals that we use for food are shipped all around the world. If you take a look at any sort of processed food that's consumed on a day-to-day basis, or in many cases foods that you get from certainly fast food restaurants and even not fast food restaurants, the ingredient lists and this global nature of where these items came from to make the burger that you consume, how many different animals, how many different species of animals actually contributed their meat to make that particular burger. It's something that's really unprecedented in the history of humanity or really any species that's been on the face of our planet. And this sort of mixing, whether it's humans moving around or the animals moving around or the accumulation of animals into our food supply, creates a radically different environment when it comes to the probability that we're going to encounter a microbe that's out there. The way that I think about contemporary human and animal populations, it's really sort of this global viral mixing vessel where something that enters into any part of the system has a much higher chance than at any point in history to spread to other parts of the planet.
Would you touch also on how medical practices contribute to the possibility of a pandemic?
Sure. One of my chapters in the book really talking about, and this was more sort of historical, because the more that we've learned about microorganisms, the more we've been able to put safety, appropriate quality assurance, and quality control measures into our medical practices. But certainly, historically, and even in the contemporary world, in some parts of the world, the way that we treat needles, the way that we treat blood transfusion, does connect human populations in ways that are very different than they were some hundreds of years ago. You know, if you look at contemporary United States right now, or most of the developed world, using appropriate testing on blood supply and using clean needles definitely dramatically changes the risks associated with this. But if you go back into history and talk about reuse of needles and unsafe transfusion of blood into individuals, obviously this creates connections between individuals that are different than the kinds of connections we had in the past. And certainly there are some viruses, notably hepatitis C virus, that we really believe would not exist without contemporary medical practices. This is a virus that doesn't spread between humans through sexual activity. It doesn't spread between humans through respiratory routes. Really, the only way it gets between people is unsafe use of needles or dental practices or transfusion. And so this is really a very modern epidemic, and it's something that I think we do have to be quite thoughtful about, but I think it's important to recognize that contemporary practices are very, very different than some of the historical practices that led to these outbreaks.
What are we currently doing to prevent pandemics?
I think that's one of the central questions that my own organization focuses on, and I do think things have changed. If you went back even 10, 15 years ago, the notion that we would fight to detect these sorts of events early and to try to move our science towards prediction and prevention of pandemics was sort of a foreign thought in people's minds. But over the last 10 years, there's been an emergence of thought in our organization and a range of other groups around the world. You have government entities like USAID and the Department of Defense through its Threat Reduction Agency, as well as the Armed Force Health Surveillance Center, that are really starting to really catch on and try to initiate entire new systems to modify the way that we think about these kinds of threats and detect them early. Certainly some of the major foundations have also played a role in our work and the work of others in trying to change the way that we focus on this. Groups like Skoll Global Threats Fund and Foundation and Google.org. And so I think there really is a change in the way that we're focusing on these things. And I think in 15 or 20 years, we'll look back on last decade and this decade as being the time when we really started changing the way that we approach these events from sort of a fire brigade, we're going to have to chase after these outbreaks when they occur, to a recognition of the importance of applying a whole range of different science and research and surveillance to the early detection of these events. Because certainly when you look at something like HIV, once a virus like that has spread around the world, it's something that's incredibly, incredibly difficult to address and takes many, many years and billions, if not trillions of dollars in terms of its impact, not to mention, of course, the most fundamental impact it has, which is tens of millions of lives lost.
What are the criteria used to determine whether an emerging infectious agent is likely to become pandemic?
Well, again, and I think this is one of the areas of very active science, right now we sort of have our rules of thumb that we use. The first question you ask when you find one of these new outbreaks, and this is something that we do on a regular basis, so we see outbreaks of novel viruses occurring in different parts of the world that we work in, and we ask ourselves the following questions first and foremost. To what extent does it have the capacity to spread, and to what extent is it harming the individuals that it's infecting? Those are really our two important variables. When it comes to certain viruses that we may find in animals where we don't even know what's going on in humans, we don't have the capacity to answer that question unless we see a jump into humans, we use other sorts of rules of thumb. Is it a virus that's closely related to something that's harmed humans or been a major disease in the past? One of the things to remember is that if you take a look at the major diseases of humanity, whether it be malaria or historical agents like smallpox or HIV, these viruses don't exist in a vacuum. If you go and look into animals, they have many close neighbors, near neighbors as we call them, of viruses or microorganisms that are closely related to them. And those, of course, because their family has a history of being bad actors, they tend to be things that we spend more time trying to identify and pin down and monitor.
What kind of surveillance systems do we currently have in place to detect emerging pandemics?
Well, again, this is something that's really rapidly changing. Historically, we've focused a lot on, and I think appropriately, on certain particular groups like influenza. You know, if you look at the WHO and the CDC, sort of our historical groups that have been focused in this area, they have very good systems for trying to predict what's going to happen to the seasonal influenza strains as it moves around the world. These certainly aren't perfect, but they're actually pretty solid. What we've lacked historically is the ability to detect completely new things early. But what you do see, and I mentioned some of these organizations earlier, is groups like the USAID, as well as the U.S. Department of Defense, and other groups that are out there trying to engage partners and create systems that are capable of detecting these events early. Just to give you an example, it would be the Emerging Pandemic Threats Program from USAID. This engages a range of different partners across many different steps in the process of how we predict and prevent and respond to these kinds of events. And it's been a very successful program that we've had the good fortune to participate in. But I really do think that across a number of U.S. government entities as well as foundations, there really is increasingly the sense that this is important work to sponsor and that future generations will look back and sort of judge us not only on our capacity to scramble once we have a virus that's spread around the world, but also in our capacity to really think about these events early and stop them before they come to a head.
You are listening to the Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Nathan Wolfe, author of the book The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age. Would you tell us about some of the new ideas that are being developed for surveillance that you speak about in your book?
Sure. I think it's just such an exciting time because, well, here's one parallel to think about, which is if you went back 10, 12 years ago and you asked people, what is the most cutting-edge way that we manage information and what are the organizations out there that we really consider to be the folks that allow us to find and process information that exists? And the answer would probably be something like Library of Congress. And, I mean, obviously, if you ask people today, it would be, you know, a search firm like Google. Technology has radically changed our capacity to understand and access information, to communicate with each other. And I think that there's a sense here in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that, and this is a fairly new sense, that there's no reason why we can't create the same level of innovation within health systems, in our case, within the capacity to detect microbial threats early. And one of the areas of interest, and we spend a lot of time here focusing on this because we're an interdisciplinary organization, so we have microbiologists, but we also have data scientists and medical anthropologists, just to name a few of the scientific fields that we focus on. But the data scientists have tremendous amounts of new data, whether it be open source intelligence, what exists on the internet, whether it's blogs or tweets or news articles or blog posts. All of these sorts of information and data points, they have massive amounts of information that might be mined in order to understand how events have occurred. And our colleagues over at Google.org demonstrated this, I think, very effectively 2 or 3 years ago by looking at search patterns. And this is one of the most dramatic findings in this new field of digital epidemiology. Folks like Mark Smolinski and Larry Brilliant, now at the Skoll Global Threats Fund, and their colleagues were capable of monitoring the search patterns that people use. And when people are ill, obviously they're going to search to a certain extent more biased in ways towards the illness, whether it's symptoms of dengue or symptoms of influenza. And they were able to demonstrate that by mashing up massive amounts of this search data, that they could see patterns that were very similar to the patterns that were detected in the CDC's influenza surveillance, but they could see them many days early. And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a tremendous amount of data that's floating around out there. People are communicating and their mobility information that we now have access to that we've never had access to in the past. And I think if we don't lock this data up because of fears of privacy and the sort of thing, I think that that kind of data is going to be useful not only for the advertisers that we've seen it used for historically over the last couple of years, but will be very useful for groups like ours that are looking for any sort of chatter, any evidence of a novel outbreak or pandemic.
Once an emerging pandemic virus has been detected, what are the best steps to stop or control it?
The good news in relation to that question is this is something that we've spent a lot of time doing. You know, we've spent a lot of time doing the fire brigade approaches. The problem is, until we have some fundamental improvements in our ability to scale up vaccines and treatments and diagnostics much more rapidly, we sort of, I think, have reached a wall of how effective we can be in terms of dealing with response. You know, I think there certainly are some areas of creativity that you see out there, ways of thinking about sort of social distancing is one of the terms used. How do we inform individuals about how to maintain distance with other individuals? But to a certain extent, certainly our belief as an organization, and I think this is a point I made very emphatically in the book, is that the real low-hanging fruit in terms of our ability to get much better at dealing with these events is to move earlier and think about these things with regards to the old dictum of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
We've been speaking about the potential for viruses to cause pandemics, but would you touch briefly on how viruses can benefit humans?
For me, this is one of these really interesting areas. We have to remember that our knowledge of viruses is incredibly recent. If we go back even 100 years ago, viruses were only known as a class of organisms a little over 100 years ago. So for most of our history, we were completely unaware of the part of life which really we now know makes up the most genetic diversity of life forms on our planet, makes up a tremendous amount of the mass on our planet. And so we were completely unaware of them. And if you could imagine, I mean, sort of, I think when you first encounter a new form of life, of course, your first question is going to be, is it really alive? And there was a tremendous amount of debate about that. But the second question is going to be, okay, these new things that we found, are they harming us? And I think that that's sort of the period of history that we're in right now. We're very obsessed about the viruses that harm us, and I think with good reason, because we haven't yet managed to contain them or understand the harm that they can do to us, and they represent, obviously, tremendous threats. But I think the next step will be, you know, how can we utilize these things and what out there is to benefit in terms of our understanding of these particular agents? And certainly, viruses are of such importance, and there's so many of them, and they're so diverse. The notion that all of them harm us, I think, is completely absurd. Biotechnology has really started to focus energy on how do we use viruses for positive effect, and certainly there's a whole range of reasons out there. And I think if we look carefully, we're going to find viruses that are actually beneficial to us. And in the book, I spend some of the time actually thinking about some of those viruses and commenting on them.
Could you give a specific example or two?
Well, sure. There's this one amazing example, and I termed the chapter The Gentle Virus just to be a little bit provocative, but there's some interesting examples in animals, but I think one of the most amazing for humans is there's a very interesting virus called GB virus. It's related to, but not very closely related to, the hepatitis C virus. And the GB viruses are very common, and we haven't known really what they do in humans, if they cause harm, but there was a wonderful study that was published, I can't remember if it was the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, but one of the top global medical journals, that showed that individuals that were infected with GB virus, or at least one of the variants of it, actually had a slower rate of progression to AIDS when they had been infected with HIV. So this is actually sort of a virus that protects individuals. We don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but it protects them and slows down the progression of AIDS. And you could imagine, this is an area where people really have not spent time looking for beneficial viruses, and considering how diverse these agents are, I think if we really go on systematic efforts to find viruses that are beneficial, we're likely to find a whole range of interesting ones.
What changes in human behavior would be most helpful in preventing plagues?
It's a great question, and I did spend some time exploring the question in the book. You know, certainly it is sort of fun, and this is kind of speculative, but to look at different cultures and the way that they address these things and the way that they greet each other. I mean, one of the case studies I made in the book was to think about Japan. Japan has a couple of interesting features when it comes to its culture and the spread of respiratory viruses. Well, obviously, there's huge population density and use of public transport, and those are things that obviously facilitate the spread of respiratory viruses. It's also a society that doesn't involve shaking of hands. And when you shake hands, obviously that's one of the mechanisms that can permit the spread of some of these respiratory viruses. So bowing probably does make a bit of a difference. And the other thing is people in the West often see these images of individuals in Japan wearing masks. And the idea for some people is that, oh, they're trying to protect themselves during a respiratory outbreak. But the reality is often it's considered a form of etiquette, and that if you're ill and you have to go out, you wear a mask to try to decrease the spread of your particular virus to someone else. And it hasn't been studied well to determine exactly what the impact of these things are. Certainly there is some impact. And obviously things like washing hands or using an alcohol-based hand sanitizer. When I'm in a meeting, for example, in the middle of winter, I just came back from the World Economic Forum in Davos, and you're shaking 100 hands, and all those people came from many different parts of the world, traveling on airplanes. Those are certainly a place where you have an increased risk of acquiring one of these respiratory-borne viruses. And so I try to make a point of washing my hands more, or if I'm in a situation where I can't wash my hands, you know, use one of these alcohol-based hand sanitizers. And these are definitely things that individuals can do to decrease their risk associated with some of these agents. And research is still sort of ongoing as to the best ways of doing it, but there are some clear ways that we can put into practice right now.
What are the chances that our last plague could be at hand in this century? What do you predict for the future?
Well, I'm guessing that you're referring to the last little bit of my book. I won't spoil the ending for people who haven't read it, but basically there is some optimism, and I think that the way that we address these threats is really radically changing. We're going to be experiencing pandemics really for some time to come. Sadly, my sense is that the impact of these things is going to grow greater before we're able to control it. But I think the good news is there's a number of organizations out there like our own, but we're just one of many that are really beginning this fight in earnest to catch these things early. And so I think it's a very, very exciting time. It's an exciting time for young scientists. It's an exciting time, I think, for governments and corporations as well as foundations to get engaged. And I do think that we really have the potential to get ahead of these things.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say the message to leave the listeners with is, you know, let's think carefully about these risks. And let's try to evaluate very carefully the media and how the media paints these things. For the media, you know, they have the challenge that they're trying to get individuals engaged, and they're trying to get listeners and get audiences together. And often what that means is either overstating a risk early on or saying that there was too much of a government response and the government overestimated the risk. I think if we compare these sorts of risks to hurricanes, we never shoot the meteorologist if a hurricane barreling for New York City turns off coast and it doesn't end up making landfall. And these kinds of risks, despite the fact that they're less visually dramatic, these pandemics are hurricanes that don't just hit one region of the world. They can hit the entire planet. They don't last for 3 or 4 days. They last potentially for years. And so while they may not be the most visually dramatic risks, I think that they're things that we need to really not let our guard up on these things and continue to focus on them and make sure that we're out there trying to improve these systems.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Nathan Wolf, author of the book The Viral Storm, The Dawn of a New Pandemic Age, published in 2011 by Times Books. For more information, check on the web at nathanwolf.net. Again, that's nathanwolfe.net. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.